Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Brian, Judge Tom Smith, the Honorable Lucinda E. Jessen presiding. The first case this morning is State of Minnesota versus Jason William Olson, number 820-1455.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's January 5th, 2022, this panel's first set of arguments in 2022. And we are hearing these arguments on zoom.gov. The same rules apply, as I know both the attorneys before us understand, as in our regular courtroom. Each side will have 15 minutes their argument and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are recording this and we'll post the recordings on our website. So please introduce yourself at the beginning of each of your arguments. If you have any technical difficulties, let us know. We'll stop, we'll try and help fix them because we do want to hear everything you have to say this morning. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready.
All right, good morning. Can you hear me? Good morning and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson and I represent the appellant this morning, Jason Olson. I raised three issues in my brief, two challenging Mr. Olson's conviction and a third challenging the district court's order supplementing the record. I would like to start this morning with my first argument that the trial court committed reversible error by allowing the state to introduce 12 pieces of inadmissible prior bad act evidence. A bedrock principle of our criminal justice system, which is codified in Rule of Evidence 404, is that the state is prohibited from introducing evidence of a defendant's prior convictions or prior bad acts to establish that his character includes the propensity to commit the charged crime. To be sure, Rule 404B includes a narrow exception to the rule if the evidence is relevant to a material issue in the case, the evidence is not propensity evidence, the probative value of the evidence is not outweighed by the potential for unfair prejudice, and finally, that the state has a genuine need to introduce the evidence to prove the contested issue. In this case, the court allowed the state to introduce 12 separate pieces of Spriegel evidence without considering whether the evidence was relevant to a material issue in the case, without determining whether the evidence was propensity evidence, without considering whether the probative value of the evidence was outweighed by the potential of unfair prejudice, and without considering whether the state had a genuine need to introduce the evidence. The court's decision to allow the state to admit the evidence without considering any of the Rule 404 requirements was a clear abuse of discretion. Because the state introduced two separate kinds of bad act evidence, the 8 prior convictions and the 4 photographs, I think it is easier to separate the two groups of evidence.
Mr. Erickson, I'm going to jump in here because I had a kind of a threshold question about what is required for district court judges, right? If you have 12 exhibits. Each exhibit has to satisfy the rules of evidence, and you would analyze them potentially separately if there are objections, even standing objections. So I guess my opening question is it proper to just consider this as two types, or because of the balancing test that the district court must apply, and as you put it, and under this bedrock rule, is it required that the district court go through each one, understanding that each successive analysis might be a little different when you put it on that balancing test. The probative value of the 9th or the 8th conviction might be different than the probative value of the 1st, and depending on how old the convictions are, et cetera. So is it required that the district court go through 12 separate 404B analyses here?
You know, our argument is not hinged on that, but I do think it's appropriate that courts do consider each individually. If you look at the court's order in this case, I don't even think the judge mentioned prior convictions. The judge just had a blanket ruling that evidence of prior bad acts could be admitted and then mentioned the 4 photographs. So I absolutely agree that when you start with one prior conviction, I mean, 404B is different than other rules, right? It has very strict guidelines as what needs to happen. The parties need to lay their cards on the table before the trial and decide what issues are contested, what issues are material, and then go through each one of those prior bad acts. Let's look at the first one, see what the date is of that, what the actual facts are behind that case. How is it relevant then go to the second one, because maybe that first one would be relevant to something that's material to the case, but the second one would just make it more prejudicial than probative, because we might only, if, for example, the contested issue in this case was whether Mr. Olson knew what methamphetamine was, I'm assuming that maybe one prior conviction of possession could establish that element. But again, in this case, that wasn't his defense. He never argued that he didn't know what methamphetamine was. And I think the facts of this case clearly establish that whoever hid the methamphetamine in a bag underneath the hood of the car with magnets on it, and the quantity of how much methamphetamine there was, certainly knew what it was, knew it was illegal, and there wasn't any issue with knowledge. So in a roundabout way to answer your question, I think that's absolutely right.
So Mr. Erickson, if I can jump in here. I mean, but your client didn't stipulate to the fact that he knew what methamphetamine was. So, I mean, just speaking for myself and not for the panel, I could see at least the argument that, well, okay, at least that most recent Colorado conviction would be relevant to that. But then, and I see your, and I, as I understand your argument, you're saying, yeah, but cumulative, we didn't need 12 pieces of evidence, right, to prove that. Could you please address for me in that context, Mr. Hershey's argument, which I, that, well, yeah, but this cumulative, which is too cumulative, you know, argument, wasn't raised before the district court. And so it's forfeited here.
A couple of responses, Your Honor. First, the defense attorney's argument, he objected to the admission of all of this evidence. And because none of it was admissible under the rule, I don't think he had to parse out any sort of separate argument to say that 12 of them is cumulative when the clear argument was none of this is relevant, none of it should come in. And second of all, because the court didn't conduct any sort of probative versus prejudicial analysis below, I don't think that precludes us now on appeal to say that the probative value of this was clearly outweighed by prejudice because of the amount of evidence that was introduced. I don't think we are handcuffed on appeal by talking about the prejudicial nature of 12 prior bad acts versus one when the defense objected to all of it coming in. So, you know, potentially I'm adding more to the argument, but it was raised below and it's not like the state is now caught off guard by, you know, we didn't know that there were 12 and, you know, he wouldn't argue that it was prejudicial on appeal. So I don't think there's any waiver argument. We raise this issue all the time. And when we're looking at prejudice, I think we have to consider how it came in and not just what was raised pre-trial.
If I may follow up on a related point, you know, I was looking back at the case law and I know you're more familiar with this probably than I am, trying to say, okay, how explicit does this balancing have to be? Because here, yes, this was a very brief written decision. On the other hand, both the parties below briefed this pretty extensively to the district court and relied upon their briefs on the Spriegel in limine motion. So could you just point me to what cases would help us say, oh, it's got, you know, that it needs to be, you know, more explicit balancing than we have here?
Yeah. You know, I don't think there are magic words that need to be said. I do think that there needs to be some sort of discussion about it. And in a case like this, where it really does potentially hinge on the probative versus prejudicial analysis, I think, first of all, the rule requires it. Second, I think State v. Rosberg, which I've cited in my brief, discusses that the appellate courts only look at the court's findings. So it's not what the state says, it's not what the defense attorney says, it's not what the state argued in opening or closing, it's what the court actually found in its order admitting the evidence or stated on the record. So I think that's all we can look at and to consider whether the court considered the factors. And again, I know we're on an abuse of discretion standard, so we have to look at something. And just the court concluding that this all can come in without doing any analysis, like Judge Brian was mentioning, not separating them out or not pointing to what actual fact that's disputed that they go to, and then not conducting the probative versus prejudicial analysis in the order. I don't know what else we would look at when determining whether the court abused its discretion. So, and again, I want to make clear that our argument is not that the error was just because the court failed to make findings. It's what the court failed to make findings about. And that's, this is, I've never seen a case where there's been eight convictions admitted without any analysis. I've never seen a case where then on top of that, there are four pictures that are admitted without any sort of substantive analysis of the need or the prejudice versus probative balancing test.
Do you view the state's case as strong or weak?
Well, for the purported element that it's trying to prove with this evidence, I think the state has a very strong case, and that's knowledge of what methamphetamine is. Like I mentioned earlier, there's evidence is extremely strong that whoever possessed this methamphetamine under the hood of the car knew what it was and knew what was illegal. There's absolutely no argument that whoever did that would believe that it was some other substance or that they could legally possess it. So absolutely.
What is the precise mens rea when it comes to knowledge here? Is it just knowledge of the nature of the substance, or is it something else that you have to know?
I do believe that the trial court and the state and their arguments kind of conflated knowledge in this case. There are two separate knowledge requirements. One is that you have to know that the substance you have is a controlled substance, is illegal. The second is just the general constructive possession knowledge, and that is having dominion and control over it. And those are two extremely different things. And I think anything, any evidence introduced to prove that he knew on that date that there were drugs under the hood of the car, that's propensity evidence. It's not knowledge as we're thinking of knowledge of what the substance was. So maybe
I could ask you to go back to Judge Smith's question there as to whether it's a strong or weak case on both types of knowledge. You've already argued that it's a strong case when it comes to knowledge regarding the nature of the substance, mm-hmm. but as it relates to constructive possession knowledge, do you think it's strong or weak?
I think anytime you have a case like this where there are multiple people in a vehicle and there's drugs somewhere else where they have to prove constructive possession, I think it's a weak case. Then adding this on top of it as propensity evidence, it definitely affected the verdict. So I don't think it's a strong case in whether or not Mr. Olson actually had constructive possession over the drugs, but that's, again, introducing it for that purpose is propensity evidence. Introducing it for knowledge of what the drug is, that might be knowledge, but again, that's not contested. And the state's case is very strong for that element.
You'd agree that it doesn't have to be just propensity evidence. There could be the facts of one of those prior convictions where there is another bag attached to the bottom of the engine with magnets or hidden in a similar way, or the same green bag or something else that would link the charged conduct to some prior fact. So in that situation, if that were true, that's not just propensity evidence. And maybe that is a 404B case, but it doesn't seem like you're conceding anything like that when it comes to the facts of these convictions.
Right. If it was introduced for a common scheme or plan, and we knew facts of prior cases that made it markedly similar, I think it would be a very different case. If they had evidence that one of the prior convictions was that Mr. Olson possessed methamphetamine in a bag underneath the hood of the car with a magnet on it, and the state said, we have presented these facts to the court pre-trial, we're going to discuss these facts and figure out if they're markedly similar to this case, and the court said, yeah, that can come in under a common scheme or plan, then we're outside of propensity evidence.
Knowledge, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be a common scheme or plan if you're looking at knowledge, absence of mistake. I mean, if those facts could also potentially be argued under that category.
Yeah, I could see that if we have all those facts, that then they could argue knowledge in a different way. If he said, I didn't know they were there, that was his defense, like it was in this case. And they said, well, you've done this exact same thing before. I think it kind of goes both common scheme or plan, and then that supports knowledge. So I think that's absolutely right. And again, in this case, all we have are the convictions listed, the date of it, and the location. And there's no way to decipher whether any of those prior convictions had any facts that were relevant to this case that were markedly similar. So, and I believe the state kind of raises that as a separate issue of how it was presented. And I want to be clear that that's not a separate issue that we're raising. We're only saying that that was one of the reasons why the state can't establish that it was relevant to a material issue, or the state can't establish that there was a need for it, because we don't have any of those facts and we can't tell whether those the prior convictions were similar to what he was charged with in this case. The second part of our argument regarding the prior bad acts is, are the photographs. And I want to be clear, like we were talking about, like I was talking about with Judge Bryan earlier, that if his court finds that the prior convictions were inadmissible and prejudicial, we are requesting that a new trial be based just on that. And I think we can separate those from the photographs. But the photographs in and of themselves, I believe, were inadmissible as well. Similar to the argument regarding the prior convictions, the idea that they were introduced to prove that Mr. Olson knew what the drugs or the controlled substance was, that it was methamphetamine, again, that was not a material at issue. It was not contested, and there was no need for that those photographs to be introduced. This idea that it somehow established that this bag in the back seat was Mr. Olson's, the state argues that they needed that to prove that his bag was his. He wasn't charged with possessing anything in the bag. In this case, he wasn't, there were no drugs or controlled substances inside of that bag. So there was nothing that was relevant to the drugs being underneath the hood of the car. I see my time is already up. If the court doesn't have any questions, I can respond in rebuttal.
It doesn't appear the panel has further questions for you. You'll have an additional time for rebuttal. Mr. Hershey will turn to you.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Scott Hersey. I am a special assistant Steele County attorney, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this appeal. In this case, the appellant never objected in district court to the number of Sprigel incidents or claimed that they were cumulative. Therefore, it's the state's position that he forfeited that issue. Further, he doesn't meet the requirements of the plain error doctrine to have that applied. And moreover, there was ample evidence to convict the appellant, even without the Sprigel evidence. And therefore, if there was error in admitting the Sprigel evidence, it was harmless.
First of all, let's start where you ended, right? This idea that there's other evidence that is so strong that the admission of the Sprigel evidence is not prejudicial. There's two parts to our Sprigel analysis, right? As a court of appeals, we are looking, as you note, to prejudice, you know, in terms of prejudicial error, reversible error. But we also look at error. And in Sprigel, prejudice is built in to the test for deciding whether there was error, right? We're looking at the prejudicial value or the probative value against the prejudicial effect of the set. So prejudice is kind of built in. So when you say that there's this other overwhelming evidence that means that there's no prejudicial error, reversible error, aren't you also conceding that there's no probative value?
Not at all. I think the probative value is extremely important here. And both the prosecutor argued that significantly in his memos in the district court, and the district court specifically found that the Sprigel evidence would be relevant and helpful for the jury. So I would submit that it is significantly probative on the issue of knowledge in three different aspects, and to rebut the alternative perpetrator theory of the defense. The knowledge included having to know that there was something under the hood. Secondly, that was methamphetamine. And third, that the possession of methamphetamine was in fact illegal.
Well, let me ask it again, because as you're arguing now for how high up the probative value was, it seems that it's hard to have it both ways. It's hard to say on one hand that the probative value was so high, but on the other hand, that evidence was unnecessary, didn't affect the verdict. Right? Isn't that what probative value really means?
No, I would not put it in those terms, Judge. We are talking about not a weak case or a strong case. We're talking about need. And in Ness, the Supreme Court said need is now not a separate finding. That simply is incorporated as part of the balancing of probative nature versus prejudicial effect. And in this particular case, anytime you have a constructive possession case with three potential individuals, there is a need for that evidence. But regardless of the fact of the Sprigel evidence, there were a number of factors that justified the verdict here. This individual was carrying $10,000 in cash. He was on a trip to Colorado where his last conviction had occurred about a year earlier. His backpack in the back of the car with his documents in it contained gram scales, which could not be calibrated without the 50 gram weight, which was actually with a methamphetamine under the hood. He stayed with the car when others went off to get jumper cables. When the police approached, he quickly slammed the hood so quickly that he left a tire iron in it to prevent the police from seeing the bag in there. He tried to resist and pull away when the officers arrested him. And he admitted in a jail call, "I did this all to myself. I regret all of this." So I'm not saying as far as the balancing goes, and I respectfully disagree that if you have prejudice, then you don't have probative value. And I would rely significantly on Turie v. State. There, the Supreme Court said that it was hesitant to reverse the defendant's murder conviction when the state called 24 witnesses to prove the Spriegel murder, when the defendant did not object to the Spriegel evidence as cumulative.
But Mr. Hershey, there, the defendant failed to object to trial. And here we have some, the appellant clearly objected to all of the Spriegel evidence in this motion in limine. That case just seems very different for me.
I would suggest, Judge, that in Turie, the Supreme Court emphasized the fact that you can't just make a general objection saying, "I object to Spriegel on every possible grounds." You have to make the specific objection that the evidence is cumulative. And in Turie, they never objected to any of the witnesses' testimony, and they never objected to the fact that the state called 24 witnesses, which the Supreme Court said was highly prejudicial, but there had to be an objection on the basis of cumulative nature of it, and that was not made. I believe there was an objection to Spriegel generally in Turie. And I would point out that there are a couple other things that Supreme Court decisions that minimize any prejudice in this case. In a leading case in State versus Ness, the Supreme Court said that prejudice of Spriegel evidence to a defendant is lessened if, one, there is a regular and repeated pattern of similar Spriegel incidents, which is what we have here, and the Spriegels resulted in convictions, which we also have here. We have Spriegels in 93, 03, 04, 05, 11, 12, 16, 18.
So, Hersey, the fact of a conviction is not a pattern, right? I mean, I think the pattern that they're talking about is something more than just there's a conviction in this year and this year and this year. Would you agree with that reading of the case?
What I would suggest is the pattern here goes to the knowledge and to rebutting the alternative perpetrator offense. And when the summary of the Spriegels was put in, it put in, and this is not a modus operandi exception, so we don't have to show that it was substantially similar to the other ones. We're simply showing that he had knowledge of methamphetamine and knowledge that methamphetamine was illegal. And in addition, that helped rebut the alternative perpetrator defense.
And Mr. Hershey, my concern is why did you need to put in anything more than the most recent Colorado conviction to establish that? I mean, why have to go back and show, marijuana possession convictions or, attempt to manufacture and things that go back more than a decade?
Well, it may have been best to have left out the marijuana conviction, but I would point out that all the other convictions listed the date of the offense, the date of the conviction, what the conviction was for, what particular controlled substance was involved, and what the particular act was, whether it was possession, manufacture, or sale. And those went to knowledge, as the district court found, and to rebutting that alternative perpetrator defense. And Ness basically said, and that is also shown in the Supreme Court decision in Rayner, that if there is a repeated specific pattern, that's going to come in. The Supreme Court seems to rely on a pattern of prior offenses. And we wouldn't have a pattern if we just let in the most recent one, the Colorado one. In fact, in Rayner, the Supreme Court upheld the introduction of 6 prior acts of violence against others to show that repeating pattern. And those were 1916 and 10 years earlier than the charged offense. So the
Mr. Supreme Hershey, Court- I'm sorry. Doesn't it matter in Rayner that that was a pattern of trying to show similar conduct, I think, an assault or propensity towards, of assault, as opposed to here, knowledge. Why do you have to have a pattern of knowledge in this context?
I would submit that is not a distinguishing factor, Judge. There, they didn't have modus operandi evidence. There were just violent incidents against other people in Mr. Rayner's life. And the Supreme Court seemed to rely there, as the Supreme Court did in the leading case of Ness, on the fact that there was a pattern of it. And it seems that the pattern allows any prejudice to be reduced, and it appears from these cases more likely that the Supreme Court would uphold sufficient evidence to demonstrate a pattern.
But wouldn't your attempt to show a pattern be character evidence, because of the cumulative effect of this tending to show that he's a bad actor? I mean, I don't understand why you need this volume on a case that's relatively strong.
The district court, in the state's view, did not abuse its discretion in introducing this evidence because of the fact that this is, of course, a constructive possession case. And there are some factors that worked in the defense favor, namely that both of the other individuals were clearly admitted meth users, and both of them possessed small amounts of a controlled substance. And so I would submit that it is appropriate to produce the pattern to show the knowledge and rebut the idea that one or both of those others, to the exclusion of Mr. Olson, possessed the controlled substance under the hood.
Were there pictures of the other defendants showing methamphetamines in their possession?
I don't believe there were photos showing their possession, Judge, but there were statements by both the male and the female, Christine Mazurek, that they admitted that the small amounts inside the passenger compartment of the vehicle belonged to them. The defendant, on the other hand, never admitted that the methamphetamine under the hood was his, and the two others denied that the meth under the hood was theirs. Christine Mazurek fudged a little bit. Excuse me. Yes, it was Christine Mazurek fudged a little bit when she was trying to exculpate the defendant, and basically said she was responsible for it, but she didn't know about it till afterwards. The jury obviously did not credit that and still convicted the defendant. And I would submit that this is a case where it's not plain error to admit the Spriegels, because there is no bright line rule establishing that 8 Spriegels would be too much and unduly prejudicial. The Supreme Court has already said that 6 Spriegels was acceptable in Rayner. So there's no bright line rule. And so I would submit that the plain error doctrine simply does not apply. And I would point out that each conviction was properly admitted to prove the same things, knowledge, and to rebut the alternative perpetrator defense. And I would point out too that the district court in its order said that it could give a cautionary instruction at the time the Spriegel evidence was introduced, and that would reduce any prejudice. And further on the record, it said that the manner of producing that evidence, namely with the summary that the prosecutor gave, was sufficient to, again, reduce prejudice to the defendant. In fact, it was the least prejudicial way of introducing that evidence. And I would submit that the district court, as Mr. Erickson did, properly divided the Spriegel evidence into the two categories of, one, the convictions, and two, the photographs. And as it relates to the photographs, I would indicate to the court that there were 4 photographs, yes, but if you look at the date and time stamps, They were all the same date. They were just minutes apart. It was simply one incident. And that was important evidence independently to connect the appellant to the methamphetamine under the hood, because it showed him using a torch virtually identical to the one that was in his backpack with his identification in the back seat. And in that backpack of his were the gram scales. And gram scales are intended to be very precise and accurate, and they cannot be accurately used without being calibrated. And the calibrating weight for those scales found in his backpack was with the methamphetamine under the hood. So the torch connected him to his backpack. The backpack connected him to the methamphetamine under the hood. So that is relevant evidence that was needed by the state. So I would submit that the photographs were independently relevant in that respect.
Mr. Hershey, if I may, and this question kind of follows up my earlier question to Mr. Erickson, can you point me to a case where we have affirmed a district court's Spriegel ruling where there was no explicit balancing of the relevance, need for the evidence, danger will be used for the wrong purposes in the either written or oral order?
I cannot. That is a requirement, but I would submit, and on this point, I would agree with Mr. Erickson, that there are no magic words to the court's balancing. In other words, I don't think the court has to use exact language out of 404B and specifically say, well, this probative value is not substantially outweighed by the prejudicial nature. What the district court did is it said in its order, it relied on cases that the state cited in its memo, and it would not repeat them there. And the state strongly argued the probative versus prejudicial nature. So it's clear that the district court was adopting the state's argument and reasoning, but it also said that the Spriegel evidence was specifically relevant to the knowledge of meth and to rebut the alternative perpetrator defense. And it said that the cautionary instructions could minimize any risk that the jury would use those prior convictions to convict him of this offense. Now that was in the judge's order. When you go to the record, which I quoted in my brief, there the court specifically found after a significant briefing by the parties again, that this manner of presenting the Spriegels was the least prejudicial way of presenting them. With those
two— Mr. Hershey, you're going to need to wrap up.
Okay, in both of those two situations, the court indicated the relevance of the Spriegel evidence, and it also indicated the balancing that it had done, and it's clear that it did consider those two factors and balance them. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Erickson, we'll turn to you for the last word.
Thank you. I just like the question regarding what the court has to say and what it has to do as far as an analysis. I think State v. Ness is the best case to look at, and I'll quote a portion of it on page 690. Says this case demonstrates the need for the district court to conduct a thorough examination of the purposes for which Spriegel evidence is offered and to weigh the probative value of the evidence on disputed issues in the case against its potential for unfair prejudice. The prosecution's need for other acts evidence should be addressed in balancing probative value against potential prejudice. I don't think there's any clear case or articulation of what the courts need to do. Since State v. Ness and subsequent cases discuss this gatekeeping role that district courts need to conduct, where they need to be the ones that, no matter what arguments are made, once it is objected to and presented, especially in written form, this was fully litigated, once it's before the court, at that time the court needs to follow 404B, make all the required findings, discuss what issues are material to the state's case, put their cards on the table, discuss what evidence is coming in otherwise, how much evidence the state has supporting knowledge, whether they need this evidence, whether they may only need one piece of this evidence versus 12. That is how important Spriegel evidence is and how unfairly prejudicial it is if it comes in improperly. And I think this is a great example. And when we're talking about harmless error, the question isn't whether the state had enough evidence if we take the Spriegel evidence out. The question is, what impact did this Spriegel evidence have on the jury? And I don't know how a jury would sit in a deliberation room with 12 pieces of Spriegel evidence and not consider them when determining whether Mr. Olson possessed the controlled substance, not consider whether he had been doing this for 20 years, and look at this pattern that the state is now arguing it somehow makes it relevant, when that's the opposite. The pattern establishes that it is propensity evidence, that the state wants the jury to convict Mr. Olson because he has a pattern of prior convictions that are controlled substance convictions. So I think that on its own establishes prejudice, and supports our position that Mr. Olson should receive a new trial.
Mr. Erickson, maybe I could have you respond to the argument that Mr. Hersey's making about Rainey, saying that in Rainey there's a pattern of convictions. I read Rainey a little bit differently to show there's a pattern of violent conduct. But what would be your reaction, your read? Is Rainey just wrong? Is Rainey also a pattern of propensity evidence that, towards violence, propensity to commit violence? And this is also an incorrect case. I think it's from, 1987?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to say that any prior appellate judges were wrong, but I do think that we do know the facts of those prior cases. And so if the court wants to say that the specific facts establish a pattern, I think, again, that's very different. If there were 12 or 8 prior convictions of Mr. Olson keeping methamphetamine in a bag under the hood of the car, I think it might be a different case where we would say, yeah, there's a pattern of this. He can't say he didn't know they were there, or that he, you know, it's kind of the common scheme or plan thing. And especially in assault cases, I think pattern of violence does come in. I personally think that that's still propensity evidence, but I understand that there is a distinction between presenting facts supporting a pattern and just a prior conviction and saying, do what you want to do with that, jury. So I think Rainey is distinguishable from this case, whether or not I believe it was rightly or wrongly decided. You know, at this point, I would just ask the court to reverse Mr. Olson's conviction and remand for a new trial. I think his right to a fair trial in this case was violated by the fact that the jury had this much propensity evidence to consider when determining his guilt. If the court doesn't have any more questions, I can end my argument.
Are there further questions from the panel?
If I could ask one follow-up, Mr. Erickson, your response to the argument that this is like Touré in the sense that there's a problem with the way that the objection was made below that means we're applying plain error.
The defense attorney below objected to it all coming in and argued that it was not relevant and argued that wasn't relevant to disputed issue at trial. There was no obligation for the defense attorney to parse out individually why, you know, make this separate, distinct prejudice argument. I don't think there's any issue with whether it was raised below. It was formally litigated and it was briefed. You know, the plain error is not an issue in this case.
Judge Smith, did you have an additional question?
I do not.
Okay. Well, with that, the court thanks you both for that helpful argument and briefing. The matter will be taken under consideration and decision issued within the statutory time period. Thank you both.
Thank you
for your arguments.